So we go around some names. Yoju.
Yoju.
Mark.
Mark. Amelia.
Amelia.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Shintai.
Shintai.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Mary.
Mary.
Clayton.
Clayton.
Ryan.
Ryan.
Rick.
Rick.
Richard.
Richard.
Mark.
Mark.
Diane.
Diane.
Domio.
Domio. Bob.
Announcements. Next Sunday, which is the 12th, the children's program. And then the Saturday after that, the 18th, is book group. The 19th is Jukai, which is when new people that come to the Sangha, if they want to formally become Buddhist, there's a ceremony that we have where they get, formally become Buddhist, and then they get like a little mini robe to see that they become like Richard's wearing, you know, that's called a wagesa. So that's on the 19th. And then June 1st is the Buddhist festival, which Shoketsu is going to tell you more about.
Right, it's a gathering of Buddhists from all over the Portland area. And we're the only ones so far, we think, on the west side of Portland. So, we sort of want to let people know about that. And it's fun to meet people. So we have a little table there and give out literature and just meet people.
And it's where and when?
Oh, it's June 1st, Saturday, June 1st, from 11 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. And there's a sign up if anybody wants to help. There's a man at a table.
And it's over, It's just across the river.
Oh, at Sanders. Yeah,
Colonel Summers.
Summers Park.
Colonel Sanders Park. I don't know what he's saying.
We've got plenty of people, but if anybody wants to, I hope that's good.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun Sangha event. You know, you just come and volunteer to sit at our table for an hour or so, chat with people who come by, then you get spelled, and you wander around and look at the others, and there's talks, and there's workshops, and stuff like that. So.
Hopefully, they a lot of times, unfortunately, like, I guess to get the permits to sell food is a lot more expensive. So some years they haven't had that, but I like it when they have, when they sell stuff. I don't know. That's not only for food, but there's sometimes booths and that sell stuff too. But.
And we can give away food, but it has to be wrapped, which to me is, I understand on one level, but if the parks department is worried about, if I have to individually wrap a cookie, things might get dropped.
Is that really,
that's what it said.
Diane, could you start passing these around? Thank you. Okay, so today I am introducing you to my 9 fields of Zen practice. I don't know if, has anybody through the podcast or anything heard anything about this? So I think I've been thinking about this kind of list for just ages and ages. Maybe since I began practice. I don't know, I have a mind that wants to organize stuff and describe stuff. And so I've always been thinking about, what are the essential aspects of Zen practice? And I feel like this is particularly relevant and helpful for modern lay practitioners, because throughout the history of Buddhism, a lot of the intensive practice has been done by monastics in residential settings, in monasteries, or their like fully ordained monks that have 250 precepts that determine exactly how they live every day. So when you are fully immersed in that kind of training environment, it really, you know, in a way it's great. You just don't have to worry about it. You just submit to the system and you pick up that everything is practice. How you move, what you wear, how you eat, how you speak, how you treat people, how you do your work. You know, it's just, it's clear that it's all practice. But in busy lay lives, which I would say I've never even lived for a prolonged period of time in a monastery. I lived at Dharmarine residentially for close to 10 years, but it was a hybrid kind of thing. So in many ways I was immersed, but I was still living a busy life like many. So, and now of course for the last 10 years I have been living essentially a lay life. So sometimes in the course of that kind of life, we don't have that kind of structure. And there are many demands on our time and attention, and so it becomes less clear how we can make every aspect of our life practice. So sometimes when I've asked people to reflect on, you know, what's your practice like lately or something like that, what people tend to comment on is, you know, how often do they make it to the Zen Center? How much do they do Zazen? And then how much do they study, you know, Buddhist stuff? And that's pretty, you know, that's what they identify as, that's my practice. I mean, that does kind of make sense that that's the first thing that comes to mind. But in some ways, I wanted to come up with this 9 fields to convey perhaps, I don't know, give a very flexible structure to any kind of life. So I will go over just all 9 of them very briefly, and then kind of start at the top, and we can just go through each field. I don't know how much discussion we'll have about each one. I'm anticipating that we won't get through all of them today, and we'll just continue on another day. So, again, this is my organizing mind. I made up with 9, and they're in 3 in each category. So, wisdom, compassion, and skillful action. So in our lineage, in Soto Zen, these are like the 3 essential aspects of our practice. So wisdom is cultivating, you know, particularly insight into the core Buddhist teachings. Compassion, and then putting it into action. And we actually have 3 bodhisattvas that we tend to put in a Soto Zen hall that represent these. And we don't have exactly the same setup, but in like a Dharmarine, Manjushri, the bodhisattva Manjushri is in the center. And that's the bodhisattva of wisdom. And then at Dharmarine, I think Kanzan's over there, and we have a Kanzan over there, the bodhisattva of compassion. And then the classic triptych would be Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva of skillful activity over there. Actually, at Dharmarine, they have Fudo instead. It's a long story, but in our lineage, Fudo kind of supplanted Samantabhadra, but he kind of stands for the same thing. We have a Buddha statue in the middle because traditionally we would meditate in like in a classic Zen monastery, we would meditate in a different hall than we would chant. So there would be Manjushri would be enshrined in the meditation hall, and then Buddha would be up on the hall in the chanting room. It's called the Buddha Hall, actually. So we have kind of a mishmash. Anyway, so in the wisdom category, we have Zazen as our central practice. We have Dharma study, which I will go into, but essentially it's it's often one that people find overwhelming when they first encounter Buddhism because there's just so much to study. But the way that I'm presenting it is we just, as we're able, as we're interested, we keep exposing ourselves to the Buddhist teachings. So they kind of soak in, they help us frame our practice. Then there's cultivating insight. So, you know, in a way, Dharma studies that just the academic aspect of exposing ourselves to the teachings, reading, listening, whatever. But cultivating insight is, it's understood in Buddhism that from the beginning, unless we verify these teachings for ourselves, they're not that transformative or liberating. To a certain extent, it's helpful to just have faith and, you know, frame your worldview in a particular way. But this is really awakening to the truth. And I'll go more into that. Then in the compassion section, there's precepts. We've been studying precepts on Tuesday, and on May 19th, people become Buddhist by taking the precepts, so our moral guidelines. And it's a really all-encompassing practice. It's not just rules about behavior. It's also a tool for studying the self. Then there is opening the heart. And this one is not... it's usually not as explicitly emphasized in Zen, but I don't know. I feel like it's really essential. And there's many different dimensions to this, but in particular, there's, you know, our bodhisattva vow, and then there's also the, to some extent, the precepts point towards some of this as well. There's certainly overlap. But the Brahma Viharas and Paramitas are very classic Buddhist teachings that can be used in this area. So the Brahma Viharas are the metta or goodwill, cultivating goodwill toward other beings, cultivating compassion, sympathetic joy. So that's goodwill. If you feel goodwill towards someone and you see them enjoying good fortune, that's what you feel, is this sympathetic joy. And then equanimity. So really working on those aspects, which it's in a way it's kind of like the precepts, where we say the precepts describe enlightened activity. But if we're not enlightened yet, we at least try to act, you know, keep the precepts, to act according to the precepts. And the Brahma Viharas, similarly, it's like, is it the chicken or the egg, you know? If you open your heart, it's actually easier to practice. And when we practice, and it helps us open our heart. So we basically are approaching it from both ends. Connecting with the ineffable is another one that I don't know. There's many different ways to describe practice. Heck, the Buddha came up with the Eightfold Noble Path. That was his first teaching. So the Buddha similarly had a list that you could follow to, you know, this is what the practice is composed of. But one of the beauties of Buddhism is that it can adapt over time. And to some extent, this list reflects what I see people needing to have their attention called to. That particularly in Zen, sometimes we tend to neglect that which is greater, because we're an apophatic tradition as opposed to a cataphatic, like Christianity, Islam stuff. That's a cataphatic tradition. There is God, and we're going to, you know, praise God, and we are going to think about God and turn our hearts toward God. And so it's aiming toward the divine, that which is greater. Whereas in an apophatic tradition, it's more like we kind of describe the ineffable by saying what it is not. So we don't want you to concretize it. We keep stripping away all the things that you might grasp at. But hopefully the end result is a sense of the ineffable, is a sense that there is something greater, is a sense of connection, of Buddha nature, of, you know, these kind of rosy things, which, I don't know, I feel like in Western culture we might need to do a little bit more celebration of, calling attention to. You know, I mean, you kind of think they're going to come to the Zen Center and like, yeah, you know, just going to sit and we're going to chant, and then, you know, I mean, we're going to study something intellectual and we're going to go away. But, you know, we don't do a lot of like, yay, you know, singing and, you know, arousing that kind of joy and celebration. So I can't see us going that far, but, we could do it some more. And then in skillful action, there's Nyoho, which I'm just using that term because we don't really have a term for it, which is acting in accord with the Dharma in everyday activities, everyday mundane activities. You know, how you wash the dishes, how you drive your car, how you pick something up, you know, all these apparently mundane things, but doing them in accord with the Dharma. And that actually, similar to these other things, they train us. So you can kind of bring the spirit, the right spirit to it and act with Nyoho, or you can practice Nyoho and gain some of the right spirit. Karma work is basically, I mean, this is Dogen's, you know, to study Buddhism is to study the self, that we, I mean, to some extent, we want to, you know, forget the self, and that's part of the cultivating insight. But we also, we recognize the absolute and relative aspects of reality. There's the absolute aspect in which we're all one, and the self doesn't exist, and then there's the relative where it certainly does, and it has habits, and some of those habits are not very helpful. And what we do has impacts on others, and we do our best to untangle our karma, to become better people as best we can, to take responsibility for our actions. So there's this kind of messy aspect of doing karma work as well. And if we neglect that, then we're using our spiritual practice as spiritual bypassing and, you know, can be actually more harmful in the long run. And then finally, bodhisattva activity. You know, there's a reason why we take that bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. So taking it, you know, in many religions, for Christianity in particular, you know, I mean, they strongly emphasize this from the beginning, that, you know, doing good in the world is like an obvious, critical, central part of this path. Buddhism, sometimes not so much. You know, it tends to be kind of, we may err on the side of kind of self-focus. You know, I'm going to work on my karma and I'm going to work on my insight. And then, you know, once that's done, hopefully then I'll be helpful to other people. But, you know, if we create that dualism of I'm going to take care of myself and then I'll take care of others, we're trapping ourselves into a attachment to self in a way. All right, so that's a very broad overview. I guess I'll just start from the top and go into a little more detail about each field. You know, there are some little practice groups forming. I have a kind of online sangha associated with the podcast. I never really set out to have an online sangha, but you know, people connect with me through the podcast, and then they're kind of in the middle of nowhere, or they're not near a Zen center they really connect with or whatever, and then they want more. So I'm kind of just responded to that. Okay. So we meet on an almost weekly basis to discuss podcast episodes, but then I've set it up so that groups of like 4 to 6 people will just meet on their own. This is via video conference, by the way. Meet on their own. And the idea is that they would structure their group around these 9 fields. And you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, really strict. It's a pretty flexible idea. but structuring it around these 9 fields, and the idea being to have the group last from 3 to 6 months, and then make some vows and identify, you know, they're in maybe 3 to 5 of these fields. So we'll see how useful that is for people, but any thoughts or questions before I delve in from the top? All right.
So, the one that's starting on Sunday nights tonight.
Yeah.
He's on 7.
No, I think it's the 9 fields as a whole. Just that you're just using it to structure your kind of what is practice, what are the different things we can discuss, and where what kind of vows might we make. So it's pretty much up to each group. I don't know, like the one group that's been going for a while, they just, and I think they just started identifying teachings they wanted to discuss, and I don't know. So, so then, you know, Shoketsu's going to be part of one of these groups, and so anybody who's a pledging member of Bright Way can participate in these for free. Like, you can either be a member of the Zen Studies podcast or a member of Bright Way Zen. So, in a way, what I envision is this turning into a book someday, like a how-to manual of Zen practice, because what I'm interested in is conveying and talking about, not I've said plenty about Zazen, but really, like, how do you incorporate it into your life? How do you make a strong habit of it? How do you, you know, how do you really actually practice with it? And that's the same with all of these things. Dharma study, what should you study? How much? When? You know, how important is it? Etc. So in terms of Zazen, I just did a podcast episode on these first 3 where I went into more detail. And one of the things that I said about Zazen was I have a growing sense that Zazen is like prayer is for Christians or Muslims or Jews, that, and particularly touched by the Muslim way of going about it, where a devout Muslim will pray 5 times a day, and, you know, it's like it doesn't matter what's happening. You make some space in your life for this prayer. And the whole idea, and I'd love to study more about this, is they call a human being is, the root of the term for human being is forgetful. That we forget God, we forget, you know, which is greater, we forget what really matters, etc. We're forgetful. So then that time of prayer is to put aside false gods, put aside all those things that we get wrapped up in that aren't the most important thing, and make space for the most important thing. So I guess more and more, I mean, I have ideas about how to sit and how to deepen your Zazen and all that, but I think perhaps the most important thing is just making that space. We find that space. So whether we're making space for 10 minutes 3 times a week, or we're making a space of 30 minutes or an hour, or we at least make a space when we come to the Zen Center or something, I think it changes the whole, it gives our life a different frame, a different pivot point. So I guess any questions or thoughts or whatever about Zazen as a field of practice?
Well, what you just said about, you know, the idea of sort of making a separate place in your life, you know, in your mind, in your actions, in your physical space, I really noticed that once I won't use the word consecrated, but I set aside a physical space in a tiny little house for and made an altar. a meditation altar.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually inside a closet, so I can just open and close the door.
Nice.
You know, then it's out space. But I almost immediately began to notice the difference in my approach to my meditation time. That it became I don't want to say deeper, but it just the sensibility that this was something special and kind of sacred.
Mm.
And it had its own definition and its own moment of time, its own location and space. And this was for my personal time.
Mm.
And I really noticed that very quickly. It sort of surprised me. Yeah.
Thank you. Shukata, you can just pick her up. She'll just stand there looking sad. I think that's beautiful. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's fine. It's fine if you just want to look at meditation as kind of a functional thing, just as kind of a means to an end. You know, you sit and do this thing and it makes you more calm or something like that. But, I don't know. I think I personally love that. And that sense that, so I go out in the morning and I do this online meditation. I've got a little tough shed out in my backyard that it's, you know, converted into a cozy room. And when I go out there, it's like, I don't know, even need to remind myself, I'm not going out there to meditate and it's another to-do thing on my list. It's like I'm going out there and I'm not going to do anything except just be. This is my vacation. This is my true mental and emotional and spiritual vacation, to take this time that I've allotted.
I have a Muslim friend who in Islamic countries and also where they have a large Muslim population, like in India, you know how the imam calls the faithful to pray five times. It's really beautiful if you've heard it. It's just really nice, especially if it's like dusk and the voice comes.
Mm-hmm.
But she, because they don't have that here, she has it on her computer.
Oh.
So five times a day. I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
Because really we are forgetful.
Yeah.
And you stop everything. And I just think it's really, really... to connect with the ineffable five times, do something to your life, you know, the humility of it.
Uh-huh. There's a documentary on Thich Nhat Hanh's Plum Village on Netflix right now called Walk With Me.
Mm.
And apparently multiple times per day there's just a bell that sounds and everybody stops what they're doing and is just mindful for a standing five count, and then they get back to their lives. That at the same time, as it looks completely bonkers to see, you know, hundreds of people in a room busily doing things and then stopping. you kind of imagine how it would feel to just every once in a while have something go, stop, check in, all right, I'm going to get back after it.
I was going to comment that listening to you talk about prayer, someone once said it's a little bit oversimplified, but sometimes prayer can be thought of as sometimes it's asking and meditation, and zazen is listening. So I like that idea of listening to God in a sense, listening to deeper wisdom that you're a part of, not God in the dualistic sense, but God as just listening for that deep wisdom that we're part of.
Well, and I had another analogy with prayer that I talked about in this last week's podcast, where, you know, we really hope at some point in our practice that through meditation that we actually get to experience samadhi, which is a state of non-dual awareness, where a sense of separation between self and everything else falls away. You know, and it doesn't have to be a, like, you know, crazy, trippy thing. It's just, it can be kind of subtle, but it's very sweet. And, but I said, look, we don't practice Zazen in order to get samadhi, even though we hope for it. So it's kind of like praying, you were like a devout theist, you know, the hoping for a connection with God, hoping to hear something, hoping to feel some kind of connection to, but they don't sit down going like, come on, God, you know, if I pray hard enough, I'll be able to make a talk. You know, that's just entirely the wrong attitude. You know, it's making ourselves receptive and listening. And sometimes we might hear something. And that's just something to be grateful for, not something to grasp after, but it's that receptivity. So I feel like that, you know, taking this time to build that receptivity toward, essentially, it's the ineffable, the absolute. It's paying attention to that aspect of our lives. And sometimes people, they think there's a kind of a tension there. Like, we're supposed to put everything down, and yet we're also supposed to respond compassionately. So should we be doing something there, or should we not doing anything in the rest of our life? But, you know, which is better, not doing or doing? And it's just like, that's a false dichotomy. We make space for not doing, and then we do. And it's having both that's important.
Okay, question for you, and I don't want to get us off topic, so you can nix it. But I'm curious to know, I love this nine fields. I have other thoughts about that. But where would you put practicing with trained positions and forms in this?
Well, this is one of the reasons why, like Daido Lori also has, he has like eight gates of Zen, and he has, one of his gates is liturgy, and one of his gates is, and in a way I didn't want to make it so specific that it entails participation in a Zen center, but
it could kind of go under
Nyoho, like,
it could go, care and attention.
I mean, because I feel like there's all kinds of Zen tools, like session, like participating in Sangha, like practice positions, that kind of, they cover like more than one field, because definitely Nyoho, also karma work, because, you know, when we're doing practice positions, when we're interacting in Sangha, the stuff comes up, like, don't tell me what to do, or, you know, now I feel nervous because I didn't do this right, or, you know, I did this job, now you're in charge of telling me what to do. You know, I mean, it's just inevitably in Sangha, these kinds of things start to come out. I mean, they do in our course of our everyday lives as well. So, so Zazen. To move on to Dharma study. Yeah.
The online. One of the differences for me between that and coming in here is the face-to-face nature of the online. And I hadn't really realized how sweet it was until I think it was Thursday. My screen just went blank. I was up there all by myself, and everybody else was a black square. And I just felt this sadness of sitting alone. It stayed that way for a while, and then another person popped up, and slowly over 10 minutes they all popped back up. And I was like, oh yeah.
Interesting.
The connection of sitting face to face is pretty dramatically different from staring at the wall.
Yeah, so we have... you know, it's this video conference thing. So I actually have my camera, and actually my computer's over here, so I'm not staring at the screen with everybody on it, but it's there in my visual field, and some people choose to face the camera, some people, you know, are facing like this, but it's a strange thing. Why would, when I described it to this tech guy before I had it all set up, and I said, you know, if a video conference software and whatever, and I, you know, because we want to meditate, and he was like, you're gonna have a video, and then everybody's just quiet. Everybody's just, he said it was kind of like, you know, a video book group where you would just read. But it's there's something about it.
Just didn't get it, did he?
And for the online sitting group that I've been with for a while, there are a few that sit in profile.
Yeah.
And I felt that was so much more like when you are viewing, or whoever's up front is viewing the rest of us. Mm. Everybody is in profile. And I'm thinking, maybe that's what I should do, because I'm, you know, looking at the camera, and like you, my computer's over here, the camera's over here. And what is giving me the most authentic, valid presentation? Mm. You know, do I stare people in the face because they're meditating? That's kind of not how we do it. Okay. But aren't there other meditation styles that do have in a circle?
Well, Rinzai faces.
Okay.
Space is the center. So a lot of times if you go to session up at Great Vow, you'll be facing each other for meditation, which feels, it's different. It's very different. It feels somewhat more supportive, but also can be a little more distracting, because then you notice what other people are up to more.
It's kind of interesting, in Buddhist groups you have list people, and you have non-list people. I'm a non-list person. And when I get all those lists, it drives me crazy. It's like a to-do thing, like all this. I can't do all this. I mean, well, they all kind of, it's not one thing or another.
Right.
When I first started doing Zazen, I had a timer, right? And it keeps track of everything. It was like, 40 days, man. 40 days in a row, and it's like, there's something wrong with this. I mean, I'm not doing this to get a count. And I don't know, I kind of, it's like a list. It's like checking things off. So, but then that's okay too.
Yeah.
So I know it's, it becomes a habit. It's kind of a good thing, because you do it all the time, but then it's
kind of
another aspect.
Well, I do feel like we come into practice and we take on practices with all different kinds of motivations, and they're rarely all pure. But I think the beautiful thing about practice is like the practice will take care of it. I feel like the practice will challenge that grasping or that competitiveness or that, you know, hope that everything will be perfect at some point, or, you know, the practice itself will bring us up against that. So I feel like, you know, we could, Roshi Kennan called that the positive use of greed, you know, I'm like, but if it gets us on the cushion, you know, but also like it just, kind of what you're saying here too reminds me, as I'm presenting this, that I don't mean to present it in a way that, you know, so your nine fields, what are you doing for cultivating, you know, what are you all about, Nyoho, what you doing, in that there's an organic quality to this, and that certain fields, certain practices, certain issues are going to be front and center for us, or maybe two or whatever, and that it's kind of okay. Like, we got, in a way we have to practice like our hair is on fire, but in another way we're in it for the long haul, so, you know, we'll get there, we'll work on some of these other things at some point, like karma work sometimes, you know, coast along pretty well for a while, and then something arises in your life that really, you know, really challenges, and now that's what you're working on. Well, why don't I just real quick go over Dharma study? So in China, at a certain point, Chan was called, identifies itself as the transmission outside the scriptures. So we have this kind of idea of Zen that, you know, we meditate, and that's a set, and you know, practice mindfulness, maybe precepts, but otherwise, it's, you know, it's a non-intellectual endeavor. It's not about learning all kinds of doctrine or something like that, which is true to a certain extent, except that that's really kind of a myth. Throughout, there's been lots of study. Lots and lots and lots of study. This transmission outside the scriptures produced its own voluminous literature about stories, about encounters between teachers and students. So it's like, so it's always involved study, but what kind of study? And again, it can be overwhelming because there's so much to study. And so it's similarly, it's this kind of, you know, you take it as you can, as you have the opportunity to, you kind of follow your nose through the study. Don't worry about like, what is one of the things that's been encouraging for me is that I've seen people come to the Zen Center, and at first, and they're kind of like, oh, you know, I mean, like classes and all this stuff and all this content, and I feel kind of overwhelmed and I don't really get any of it. And but then after a couple of few years, they're kind of like, you know, it's starting to kind of come together. I'm kind of getting a sense of it. And I mean, no one would claim to, you know, now I know all the Buddhist teachings, but after a while, it does start to make some sense. So I say that as a matter of encouragement. So we don't need to rush. But I feel like if everybody's just doing a little, you know, keeping that process of exposure up, whether you're doing a deliberate course of study, which I have some suggestions on the podcast for what to start with, or whether you're just, I've always found basically like, you know, I hear something in a Dharma talk or pick a book up in a store or whatever, and if it intrigues and it inspires, then I go with that, and then usually it kind of leads to something else and leads to something else, and so it's kind of an organic process of study that seems to work just fine. However, it does pay for us to be familiar with the really foundational Buddhist teachings, which, if you're curious, I have podcasts on most of the really core teachings now. So the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks, Karma, you know, that kind of stuff. And in a way, I feel like there's a couple things we're doing with study. One is we are gaining a, it's conceptual, it's language, but we're human beings, and that's, we need that in order to really function. So I think that what we're doing is we're laying the groundwork so that if and when we have a spiritual opening, it will come to us in Buddhist terms. If you were a devout Christian, it probably would come to you in terms of God. We're rewiring ourselves a little bit so that when it happens to us, we say, "Oh, I had a glimpse of emptiness." You know, I mean, I think the ineffable is more profound than language, so it can be described many different ways. So by getting familiar with the Buddhist teachings, we're kind of committing ourselves to experiencing our spiritual self, our spiritual path, in Buddhist terms. So that's one aspect. And the good thing about that is it gives us some language for it. It's very helpful. I think there's people out there who have spiritual awakenings and they have no rooting in any tradition and they don't really know what happened. But we're giving a framework for that. But also, then we can communicate about it with each other. Which I think is a huge valuable part of the process. But also, I see study as being less about accumulating new ideas and more about challenging the ideas we already have. We already have lots of ideas, lots of assumptions about the way the world works, about who we are, everything. So it's not like we're just like a blank slate and now we're accumulating Buddhist ideas. We have lots of ideas and we're attached to lots of them, where the teachings are often challenge that and inspire us to shift or let go of our ideas. So, and I guess in terms of like, you know, so you study those basic Buddhist teachings, but I also see the Dharma, the vast Dharmic library, as being kind of like a tree, where the, you know, foundational teachings of the Buddha are the trunk. And then, you know, there's got these big, huge branches like Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada. And then, you know, it differentiates even more. So that by the time you get to the edge of a branch, you know, there's been lots of divergence. So we're, you know, at the edge of this little branch and we share a branch with Great Vow, but it actually, Great Vow, Heart of Wisdom, branch actually branches off, like, I don't know, couple hundred years ago? It's actually quite a while. So, and then there's little divergences. And so the way that I recommend going about study is to kind of, at least at first, stick to your branch. Do the foundational teachings, you know, stick to Mahayana, stick to Zen, stick to Soto Zen, stick to, you know, kind of contemporary folks. And you definitely don't have to limit yourself like that. But sometimes, I mean, there's that diversity over the edge of the tree that if you're kind of in your initial stages of study, your initial stages of gaining faith in the practice, studying, you know, across can be a little confusing because this branch is going to say exactly the opposite. And this, you know, and it'll be just like, but. So every one of them is legitimate in its own way, but has a very, very different approach, very different flavor. So kind of if you want to get a strong Dharma study basis for your own practice, I recommend that. Sticking to your branch. I know most people aren't going to, but, you know, that's what I suggest. Any thoughts or questions about Dharma study?
After a few years of acquaintance, I pick up a book in the store and see, I think I've heard that before, you know, in a different way.
Yeah.
And it would happen to be a Tibetan book. But, it's encouraging that you can really the tips of the other branches,
yeah,
to something that you've studied pretty more directly in your own branch.
Yeah, I mean, then you end up really being able to appreciate the diversity and recognize in what ways it's very similar. Like, I feel like actually I have an appreciation and understanding of Christianity now that I didn't back when I was a Christian, that it kind of coming through my own branch, I'm like, oh, that's what you're talking about. Oh, okay. You know, you have a different way of putting it, but.
Just going to comment that early on, it's hard to, if you're perusing a bookstore, it's kind of hard to know what your branch is sometimes because there's so much out there, and
yeah,
there's a lot of great contemporary authors. So it is, I think that's actually kind of good advice to even just know if it isn't sort of Mahayana Soto or, you know, Zen Soto, to kind of know that you're getting into a different branch, because sometimes it's really confusing at the beginning, like what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's also interesting, that advice about sticking with your own kind of tradition. I think that's helpful because the vocabulary can be so different. Like, you know, in other traditions, they talk about ego a lot, and that's not really a term that we use in this lineage as much. And so it can get kind of, like, that's just an example. It's
yeah.
just the vocabulary is a little different, so it can be tricky. That experience.
What are your relationships to Dharma study? Do you like it? Not like it? Like, I don't know. Do you like it? What you feel, maybe you like it too much, you know?
So, I started out on a project to start with Chan, or stuff that's ever so slightly before the start of Chan, and work my way forward about a year and a half ago. And there's an enormous layer, especially with Chan, of sort of literary references and poetic allusions. You know, to a certain extent, I'm still just reading it, because quite often I don't know quite what they mean when they're talking about a dragon toying with a pearl or things like that. And then you'll come around a corner and read some little passage, you know, where a monk is asking a question that's very close to your heart, where Hongzhi Hall's often delivers a paragraph of beautiful poetic description of how it is. It is the way you could say it if only you had the words. At least with the Chan, I found it very heartwarming to realize that no matter how it stylistically has changed, we're fundamentally in the same business as they were in, you know, 500 to 700 AD, and that people are still people. And that we're not bent or broken in some especial way.
And along those same lines, I've been studying outside, you know, before I came here, a lot. And I'm still trying to get my mind around 2,500 years of teaching, commentaries on the teaching, commentaries on the commentaries on the teaching. Student and teacher relationships and the learnings that came out of that, and then commentaries on those contacts. And I'm so detail-oriented and analytical, I'm almost in analysis paralysis over 2,500 years of stuff. And then to go into the various lineages, you know, Tibetan stuff is really interesting, really... What's the actual name for that line?
Vajrayana.
Vajrayana. Thank you. There's so much there, and so much of it is art and sculpture and things that, you know, I'm tactile, very much so. And so there's so much there in a literal sense. And then there's the teachings, and then there's the commentaries on the teachings. And it's mind-blowing, but I also have to be very careful not to get overwhelmed and stay focused on, okay, follow this thread like you're doing, and then follow another thread, you know, and see where that takes me.
Well, there's also this aspect, I guess, with the exception of those really core foundational Buddhist teachings, mm-hmm. with you know, getting familiar with those, but then, and I think you'll probably back me up on this, like, I feel like I could penetrate all the Dharma by studying one thing. Not just, I could just study Dogen, or actually I could just study one Dogen fascicle. And if I really, really absorbed myself in that, I don't know, I just had this sense that it would all be there. I could get everything I needed from that one, because it's kind of like a, kind of like Indra's net, right? It kind of, like each of these little things, just the profound ones anyway, just reflects it all.
Sort of like a holographic presentation.
Yeah, so sometimes I feel like I do too much of, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I'll still do a little, sometimes it's just like, you should just like pick one and just concentrate on that and just become an expert on it and absorb myself in it. And I don't know. It's hard to pick, but that's probably the only reason I don't do it.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. Yeah, it makes me think of, like, because we're in the midst of precepts study, how did you penetrate one of the great precepts completely? You opened up all of them. It's the same with the sutras. Yeah. But it's hard to stay focused.
Well, with that, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Have a lovely rest of your day.